Welcome to the Legatum Institute. We are a nonpartisan, sort of apartisan, public policy think tank. We work on mostly not British problems. We publish something called the Prosperity Index, and we look at transitions and countries in the process of changing themselves all around the world. I'm Anne Applebaum. I'm a journalist by background, and I'm now here working on, actually, on transitions, and particularly on various issues, but one of the things I do work on is media and transitions, and I'll just in 10 seconds explain why I'm interested in it. I spent about 20 years working in Poland and Russia. I've written a couple of books about that region. One of the things that made the biggest impression on me in the years I wrote about Russia between, 1991 and the present was what happened to the Russian media. Namely, in the early 90s, it was very free, very interesting, just coming out of Soviet totalitarianism. There was a lot going on. There were new newspapers. People took over newspapers. There was an enormous amount of energy. Fast forward 20 years later, and the Kremlin controls most of the media. And that was done through, essentially, because the journalists in that early period didn't have a sense of what keeps media free. So they thought free press just meant you could say what you want and there would be a law and freedom of speech and that would be enough. And it turned out that that wasn't enough. What you need is the kinds of institutions that are so deeply embedded into British culture and British life that we don't think about them. Like the fact that you have a BBC, which is ruled by not directly by Parliament and not directly by the government, but by an independent institution. When you go around the world, you discover that the concept of publicly funded yet not government controlled boards or institutions are almost unheard of in many countries, and you have to spend a lot of time explaining them. One of the other things that kept the British media free over 200 years, at least till the present, when maybe it's not going to be free anymore, as you'll explain to me, as my guest will explain, one of the other things that kept the media free was that it was owned by different people and that there were laws about who could own it and what percentage of the press you could own it. And I came to the conclusion that media regulation, which is almost, and I wish I could think of a better word for it because it's one of the world's most boring topics. If you say media regulation, everyone's eyes glaze over. I mean, and as we're learning, I think probably in Britain this week, is incredibly important in countries that don't have it and don't know what you're talking about. We did some work here in Libya, and I have a colleague here who did that work, and she wrote a paper that describes it, what she did there, called the Libya Media Wiki. This was an attempt to track what was happening in Libya's media system in real time. And we also did some work in Rwanda, and we have another paper here which talks about that work in Rwanda and in Libya by somebody who worked with us there. And one of the things we discovered was that, so when you talk about media regulation isn't something people are thinking about, but it turns out to be very fundamental to democracy and in some ways to development. I mean, if you want a free conversation in any society, if you want people to be able to debate topics, to debate politics, to debate economics without killing each other, then you need some kind of regulatory system that underpins that. And it's the thing that almost nobody ever thinks of or wants to talk about because it seems so, in a country recovering from a revolution like Libya or even a decade later, 15 years later, a genocide like Rwanda, media regulation is never at the top of anybody's list, but it turns out to be a very, in our experience, a very fundamental piece of what keeps societies free and then ultimately prosperous. And that's, I'll say a little bit more about that later, but first I would like to introduce Chris Blackhurst of The Independent, who's probably the real expert on British media regulation in this room. In fact, certainly I'm not. And he will talk about how that's changing. Maybe he'll introduce the subject, and then I'll talk about some of our experiences in explaining to people, you know, the number of times I've been in countries and I say, what kind of television do you want? And people say, we want the BBC. And then you say to them, well, you know, it's very amusing that because in Britain they hate the BBC. And they all say, ha, 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 they don't believe me. But in any case, I'll let him speak.
It's not true.
It's not true?
That's simply not true.
Oh, really? Because lots of people I know hate it. But anyways.
Yeah, but that's not everybody.
No, okay, well, that's not everybody. All right, well, anyway, it is frequently criticized in Britain. We can agree that it comes...
No,
no, not the Daily Mail.
You're right, it should be.
It is very frequently and often criticized.
That's
but,
not the same thing.
Okay, anyways. I was intending that as a joke, but anyway... But anyway, I'm delighted to hear from Chris, who will talk about, and I hope we'll get into the topic of how the British press actually works and how it could be a model in other places.
Well, first of all, I'm Chris Blackhurst. I'm editor of The Independent, and I'm editorial director of The Independent and I and Evening Standard. I realise my voice is a bit croaky. I was at a leaving party that went on very late last night, so I apologise. The short answer to the question, is the British press the best in the world? The short answer, very quick answer, would possibly be yes. No other country in the world has as diverse a press as we have. No other country in the world has papers from Red Tops to the Financial Times, from left to right. A huge swathe of opinion, of fun, of dynamism, stories galore. Our record of breaking scoops must be second to none. I've not checked in the world. Obviously, the Americans have their scoops, Watergate, etc., My Lai. But, you know, starting from William Howard Russell in 1854, writing dispatches to the Times about the appalling conditions of the troops in Crimea, right through to MPs' expenses and onwards, our press has just broken story after story. And it's one of those phrases that we have, you know, we like to trot out. We have the best press in the world. And we've just heard some people actually think that. And you know, in a way, this is a no-brainer question. And it's extremely competitive press. We're not static. I don't go to my desk. You know, the first thing I have to do every day, I'm now reading it online, but the first, you know, when I go in this morning, when I get to my office this morning, there'll be a big pile of papers. I'll be reading them all, scanning them all, looking for stories, looking how they did that. And I will include The Sun in that, just because I'm editor of The Independent. Doesn't mean I'm not looking at all the press. I admire the journalism. Some of the journalism that they do, and on that level it is fantastic. I mean, the British press is fantastic, but you have to, and there's a big but, and the but is that if we're so good, sales are falling. Well, you can say that's entirely down to the internet. I think that's true to a point. I think the internet obviously has decimated the sales of print, but maybe not entirely. I'd argue that there's too many papers. We have too many. We have this enormous diversity, but certainly in the case of my newspaper and The Guardian and The Times, Financial Times in print, The Observer, I'm not sure how they break out the Sunday Telegraph in their accounts, but... quite a lot of papers are losing a lot of money. You know, the Guardian, which is probably the paragon of left-wing liberal thinking in a country that prides itself on left-wing liberal thinking, is losing £1 million a week. The Independent has never made a penny profit in any day in its history. I think it's a fairly short history, but we've never made a penny profit on any day. And then that's the business side, and then the other side is that we currently have 60 journalists arrested, over 60 arrested. Some have been charged. Some, if they're found guilty, and it's quite a good prospect they will be found guilty, will go to jail. We've had one newspaper close in pretty dramatic circumstances, having been exposed as hacking the phone of a girl who'd been kidnapped and sadly killed. And you can't get lower than that. I mean, you can think of stories that are horrific, behaviour that's horrific, but actually that's pretty low. And even if you say, as has been excused, that The Guardian, when they wrote the story of Millie Dowler's phone, didn't quite understand how mobile phones work and that the messages were being deleted automatically. It wasn't just somebody ringing her phone and leaving messages and actually deleting them. Nevertheless, it was still a pretty shocking thing to do. And what's fascinating about this question, and we've heard that apparently the rest of the world admires the British press, the current rating of people like me in terms of trust in society is 7%. Only 7% of the British public trust journalists. We're in good company. Politicians are also 7%, and bankers are 7%. Nurses, when this was a survey done at the end of last year, nurses 82%.
Expect that might be lower now.
Well, no, not at all. Nurses, doctors about 81%. So we've got this real dichotomy. We've got this fantastic model that the rest of the world apparently admires. You go into a news agent, you turn on TV late at night on Newsnight, you turn on TV early in the morning, there's people sitting there with nice round tables and they're all sitting around discussing the press, and there's a huge array of stories to choose from, whether it's some celebrity tittle-tattle at one end to serious real politic at the other, and there's scandals being exposed galore, and we're all immensely proud of it, and everybody in this room grew up reading the papers and our parents read the papers, and we think they're some of the biggest brands in the country. They hold enormous power. The people who own them are household names. So we've got all that on one side, and then we have this 60 journalists arrested, and our trust rating is 7%. And that brings me on to the next thing, which is the need for reform. Should honestly speak for itself. I mean, there are those in my industry who have their heads in the sand, who can't see that we have to change. It's been coming for a long time. I don't hold a candle for Hacked Off. I am pretty repelled, actually, by some of the Hacked Off tactics and what they've been up to. And I think they blur genuine concern. I think they've got agendas that we don't even know about yet. They've not come out yet. and I don't really have much to do with Hacked Off at all. I come from the point of view that I stick to that figure. I stick to the figure 7%. That's good enough for me. If only 7% of the British public think that can trust journalists, then journalists have to change. In the same way that bankers have been drag kicking and screaming to change their pay models, in the same way that politicians had their not all politicians had their expenses fiddling exposed, and that's changed. We on our side of the fence, the press, we have to sort ourselves out. Which brings me on to Leveson. I didn't agree with Leveson. I thought Leveson was a politically pragmatic, classic yes minister parking of a problem. We had a absolutely fevered atmosphere. It's quite hard to imagine now, looking back. July 2011, we had the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone, which brought hacking into the public consciousness. Until then, nobody cared. The Guardian and The Independent and to an extent the Financial Times had written a story about hacking, The press were the public weren't bothered. Hugh Grant, Steve Coogan, Charlotte Church, people were shrugging, think, well, they're Sienna Miller, they're all rich people. Half the time they want publicity for their films and their concerts and their albums, and the next time they don't, they can't have it both ways. And that was the public attitude. Suddenly, Millie Dowler, that changed everything. You saw the amount of interest and emails and our mailbag just went through the roof on the Millie Dowler story. July 2011, when that broke, it coincided with the growing embarrassment of a Prime Minister who had had a communications secretary who was immersed in all this, and at the same time, that Prime Minister, that government, was going to be asked to give approval to a multi-billion pound takeover of a company by a mogul who previously employed that communications secretary. So there was a collision of sort of whiff of business scandal and conflict of interest with the scandal of Millie Dowler, and they both came together in July 2011, panic in Downing Street, and the Prime Minister's solution, which was the time-honoured solution of British Prime Ministers faced with a crisis, was to ask a judge to hold an inquiry. The inquiry was deeply flawed. It should never have been allowed to have been set up with that remit, because the one subject he couldn't look into was hacking, because hacking had, by then, the police were getting their act together, they were investigating, they were beginning to arrest people, and it was immediately sub judice, so that the judge had been set up on the back of hacking couldn't look into hacking. There's very little in Leveson about hacking. He couldn't go there at all. So the solution from Sir Humphrey and others was to give the inquiry the broadest remit possible, which was to look at the ethics and practices of the British press. And what we had was a year-long inquiry. I appeared before it. I was questioned there. Whole areas, given that remit, it wasn't just hacking, whole areas of practice and ethics were ignored. Leveson did not go near the PR industry. There are now more PRs in Britain than there are journalists. I don't have anything against the PR industry. I've dealt with them all my life, and many PRs are my friends. But if you're going to look at the ethics of the press, then you should surely be looking at not just journalists who make money out of the press, because they pay my wages, but you should also be looking at PRs who earn vast profits from influencing the press. He didn't look at lobbying. He didn't look at the way that, I'll give you an example, the way that sport, just two areas at the top of my head, sport and fashion, completely control the press. We recently wrote something that upset Alex Ferguson. We said that he had been saying at the Carrington training ground for Manchester United that Wayne Rooney had never been fit since the start of the season. He had a weight problem. This was being said openly at Carrington, at the Manchester United training ground, where the press have fairly free access. Ferguson's response was to bar the Independent from Carrington, from his press conferences. So suddenly I'm faced with a dilemma. Do I obey that, or do I deny my readers any insight that could be gleaned from an Alex Ferguson press conference? Likewise, if our fashion editor is rude about Gucci, I can expect that the fashion editor will not be invited to the next Gucci show in Milan. None of this was dealt with by Leveson. There's whole other areas I could go into that weren't dealt with by Leveson. Leveson produces his report, which had been signalled all along. When I appeared before Leveson, we had sort of questions from the barrister towards the end. The last 20 minutes was a bit like a fireside chat. with Leveson asking me what should happen and how should the press be regulated, what do I think of the Irish model, etc., etc. He flagged it all the way along what was coming. There was no secret. There was no surprise. The biggest surprise was that the Prime Minister who'd appointed Leveson appointed this inquiry at cost of, I think it was north of £3 million, ignored his main finding. Stood up in the House of Commons and said that he wasn't going to have press regulation backed by statute, even though Leveson regrettably, reluctantly, in his report, had come to the conclusion it was the only safe way. In the Leveson proposals, a media regulation is a tedious subject, but it's not really. I mean, it's very straightforward. What we're trying to do, when you look at where you get this 7% figure from, and when you begin to think, where has trust gone? Why has the British public lost so much faith in its journalism, despite the fact we all think our press is wonderful? It's a strange dichotomy. Some of it is the straight behaviour of the press that can be sorted out. For instance, the press traditionally has had a practice of attacking somebody on page one and putting the apology on page 32. That, frankly, it shouldn't happen. It's inexcusable. Why should that happen? Likewise, I mean, you could go on. I mean, the one of the key things from Leveson that he got into, which in many ways was the meat of Leveson, the pursuit of celebrities is one thing. And it became very repetitive at Leveson, hearing these celebrities going up and their stories. You know, there wasn't much sympathy for them, really, and there still isn't. But where there is genuine sympathy is for Chris Jeffries, the guy in Bristol, wrongly accused of murder, for Kate and Jerry McCann, who were on the front page of the Express, I think, virtually every day for a year. Some of those stories were made up, completely made up, no truth in them whatsoever. And the Daily Express admitted so. For the couple in Glasgow, an ordinary couple in Glasgow, whose daughter underwent terrible bullying and torment, and I think she ended up killing herself, and it was just because she'd been hounded by the press. It was a terrible story. It came out in Leveson. Stories like that of ordinary people who had no form of redress. And the only way at the moment you can get redress from the press is two ways. One is the libel courts. The libel courts are very expensive. They'll take forever. And if you take us to court, we will employ a barrister and they will take you apart, as they would anybody. That's what barristers do. It's what we pay them to do. So that's one way. And the second way is the Press Complaints Commission. The Press Complaints Commission was nothing more than a reader's complaints bureau. It had no real powers. It had the power to require me to publish a judgment, which I didn't like doing. No editor likes, nobody in this room, forget editors, nobody in this room likes their peers sitting in judgment on their work. It's a very uncomfortable feeling. And the idea that we sat there and we agreed among ourselves what the judgment was going to be in some cosy club, that was not the case at all. When I've been subject to Press Complaints Commission investigations for the work we've done, it's very uncomfortable. I don't like the people on the PCC looking at our work, examining how we got the story, why did we get it wrong, etc., etc. Nevertheless, the public perception was that it was a cosy club. And this is the problem with the press, where we are now with Leveson. There is a public perception that is wrong, and has come back to this figure, 7% trust. There is a large element of the press, Daily Mail, Daily Telegraph, to an extent News International, to an extent The Express, who are in denial about the need for change. There is another group, Independent, Financial Times, Guardian, who recognise the need for change. That's pretty weird, because we're supposed to be at the liberal end, the liberal left end. You'd think we would be the ones advocating a free press. We don't want regulation, get lost. But we actually recognise the need for change. And when you go through Leveson and go through it minutely, I don't propose to do that now unless you really want me to, but there isn't actually anything in it that stops us doing our job. It is complete nonsense. The stuff you are reading is hysterical nonsense. Absolute nonsense from beginning to end. And it's being whipped up by people who, frankly, it was coming for ages, and they behaved as though this thing has landed from a cloud. They had warnings galore. They never even, if you go back through the cuttings, the time that David Cameron stood up in the House and said, I'm not going to have statute, and Labour and the Lib Dems did, if you go back through the cuttings, barely anything was written at that time about Leveson. I mean, it wasn't the Leveson report. I sat in a room about as big as this at the back of the Delaunay restaurant after Leveson appeared. We went to Downing Street, we saw the Prime Minister. The following day we went to Delaunay and we sat round the table. There were 21 editors in the room. Every single editor was there. It's the first time it's ever happened. We had the Daily Star, the FT, the Guardian Times, Paul Dacre was there. Every single editor was there, and we agreed, and it took less than an hour. It didn't even reach 1 hour. We went through virtually every single thing on Leveson and ticked them. And we ticked arbitration. We ticked the displaying of apologies. We ticked the rights of third-party pressure groups to bring complaints. You know, if I write a story about Israel, if Robert Fisk writes a story about Israel, and Robert Fisk is at his most extreme, as he often is, I can expect that the Jewish lobby will bombard me with complaints. That's a third-party complaint. Or I write an article about some disability campaign. Their right to complain. What's wrong with that? We ticked that box. We went right through. The only sticking point, Paul Dacre's only red line at Delaunay, and this was the phrase he used, my red line, was the right of journalists to write their own code of conduct, which everyone round the table thought was reasonable. Most people in this room, if you've got codes of conduct, you would expect that the practitioners in that industry ought to be able to write it and have, you know, they have knowledge of it, and they ought to be involved in its creation, and that was fair. That was the only red line. There was a red line on statute, but the Prime Minister then came up with this solution via Oliver Letwin of a Royal Charter. And I was at the meeting when the Royal Charter was announced at Downing Street, and we're frightfully clever, none of us dared sort of betray any ignorance and say, what's the Royal Charter? How does the Royal Charter work? As soon as we got back to our desks, I guarantee that 21 editors were Googling Royal Charter and looking up on Wikipedia and thinking, oh God, right, okay, it's the thing that rules, governs the Bank of England, it governs the BBC, it governs Cambridge University.
It's the thing they don't have in most countries.
Right. Are those three institutions, and there are actually 350, I think it is, 350 institutions across Britain which are ruled by Royal Charter. Are they prevented from doing their jobs? Absolutely not. You know, is the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge University going to say to us, Cambridge is restricted because it's ruled by Royal Charter? Utter tosh. However, and this was the bit, Royal Charters are administered by the Privy Council. What's the Privy Council? The Privy Council is a collection of senior politicians, serving ministers, and senior members of the opposition. It meets, nobody knows when, it meets in secret, its meetings are never, the minutes are never published, we don't know what goes on at the Privy Council, we don't know who attends, we don't know what decisions they take, it meets entirely in secret. And that was the bit of the Royal Charter, the bit about the Royal Charter that made several members of the press sort of gulp and think, hang on a minute, the government's, well, this is awful, you can't have the Privy Council meeting in secret and changing press regulation. So the government a few weeks later, stepped forward, let win again, and said, I'm going to add a bit of statute. I'm going to put some statute on that says you can't change the Royal Charter without a two-thirds majority of the House of Commons and House of Lords. Two-thirds is pretty extreme, pretty hard to get. Again, everyone in the room nodded. Roll forward a few weeks, a few months. We're now in this hysterical thing. There is this terrible statute that is trying to control the press. Utter, utter bilge. It is there. It was introduced. I don't speak for the government, although I'm doing a fine job. It was introduced to protect the press. It was introduced to protect the press, to stop the Privy Council meeting in secret and changing press regulation. It is a one-paragraph statute, and that is all. So the amount of hysteria that you've witnessed in the past fortnight is incredible. And of course you're going to have libertarians like Fraser Nelson saying, I'm not going to be part of it, seeking publicity for his own magazine, because Private Eye, which is not part of it, is still the fastest growing magazine in Britain. He's bound to say it and come out. But for other papers, they've put their heads in the sand, they're ignoring the 7%. They think it will go, we're hoping, I think, that it will just go, die and go away. And we'll be with the status quo and life will go on as normal. I think I've talked for too long. But if you want to, I'll fire away with any questions or anything. But that's where we are. And I think what's happening in the Leveson debate is that the pro-reformers, who I suppose are myself, Rusbridger, Lionel Barber, and one or two others, I don't know if we're winning. I think that the anti-reformers, the reactionaries, are, I think they're realising that, and this is, I think, the key point for them, is that despite all their hysteria, despite their headlines, 4 pages in the Mail, I mean, they devoted 12 pages to Dave Bell. Dave Bell's one of the nicest guys you could possibly meet, one of the most switched on heads in the business, but apparently he's part, according to the Mail, of the Labour liberal nexus that controls Britain or seeks to control Britain. 12 pages on one guy. Despite all that, and the Telegraph and the Times and everything, the public traction that they're seeking is not there. There is no public mood that says, dear Daily Mail, dear Daily Telegraph, you're so right. It is clear to us that the press does not need tighter regulation. Please carry on the way you are. There is no public mood for that. 75% of opinion polls, consistent finding, it doesn't matter which poll, which company you use, 75% of the British public think there ought to be tighter press regulation. All three main political parties think there should be tighter regulation. A judge appointed by the Prime Minister held a year-long public inquiry, saw hundreds of witnesses, took millions of pages of evidence, thinks there should be tighter press regulation. How much evidence do you need that there should be tighter press regulation? I'll stop.
I will coordinate a conversation, but I would like to make one comment, which is that while the Leveson, the phone hacking scandal and then the Leveson inquiry were going on, I happened to be in Rwanda, and I was with a group of people who I was working with. They subsequently went on to continue the work, who were helping the Rwandans design a new set of media laws. And just for those of you who need a little bit of background, Rwanda is a very authoritarian society. It's also a post-genocidal society where the very thought of free speech and free discussion and free media makes people anxious. One of the causes of the Rwandan genocide in 1994 was a radio station that was encouraging the genocide. So when you say to Rwandan government officials, why do you need control over your radio? They say because of 1994, and it's they had become, you know, there it was. It has been over the last decade. It had been increasingly repressive. Lots of journalists were locked up, but at some point, they decided they needed a new way of dealing with the press and a new way of dealing with public debate, particularly if they want to grow and develop and so on. There are reasons why, even for the sake of economic development, you need some kind of national conversation. And so me and another group of people who had experience mostly in the British media, one of them was a former BBC, he'd been the BBC, the head of BBC Africa and the Middle East, and he had helped set up the BBC Arabic language station. We were in Rwanda. They were helping rewrite the law. And one of the things that came up several times in conversations that I had was because part of writing the law in Rwanda was also convincing the Rwandan elite that they needed this change. And one of the things that frequently came up was hacking and the British press. You know, you all come from Britain. You say everything there is so wonderful. How come, you know, how come this could happen there? And one of the responses we had was, well, hacking is illegal, and buying material from the paying off the police is illegal, and those people are going to jail. And those are laws that govern not everybody, but I mean, sort of, they govern not just journalists, but they govern everybody. So these are people who broke the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And one of the principles that we were trying to encourage in the rewriting of the media law was that actually there shouldn't be separate laws for journalists, because what they wanted was, you know, rules and regulations about how journalists can operate. And we said, no, there should be laws about freedom of information, and there should be laws about libel, and there should be laws about, you know, hate speech if you want. I mean, most countries have laws on hate speech, some more harsher than others. Maybe there's an argument that Rwanda should have a more restrictive law on hate speech, and they should apply to everybody, not just journalists. And it seems to me that principle, which comes from Britain, and is one of the things that's the most admirable about the way the British press has until now been run, is an excellent one. And so my question to you would be, why does the legal system need to be changed just for journalists? And second of all, this is, I'm partly playing devil's advocate, but and second of all, why isn't the British press itself, why is there no self-regulation system?
Right.
Why is there no internal regulation system that the press could come up with? I mean, that was the system we were actually recommending
right.
for Rwanda.
Let me answer those two questions. First of all, the legal system is not being changed for the British press. We're actually, what's being proposed is a new self-regulatory system. There is a one-paragraph statute that says nothing at all. I mean, it is literally about amending the Royal Charter in the future. It's a self-regulatory system. We do have laws in this country against bank robbery, but every day somebody robs a bank. Hacking was about a group of people who stumbled across something, realized whether, I mean, in those days, by the way, it wasn't illegal, it became illegal. Hacking and paying public officials, they weren't investigated by the police properly because too much media ownership, too much power resided in 40%, 38% of the British press, 38%, you know, this fantastic business model, 38% of the British press was controlled by one individual. The power that that individual had and his company had was huge. And the threat that they were always able to bring to the police, which was, if you investigate us, we will investigate you, which is what was being said in private, was enormous. The police the police did not do their job properly. If the police had done their job properly, we would have had hacking arrests and arrests for bribing officials a lot
earlier. Years
earlier,
yeah.
So, but first of all, there is no law to control the press. Secondly, why does self-regulation need changing? Because self-regulation doesn't work. We've not just had hacking. We've had a sea of scandals. All sorts of scandals. I mean, you can take any of the episodes I've mentioned. You know, you might think in any other industry, everybody in this room Think about it for a moment. The Daily Express admits making up stories about Kate and Jerry McCann. Now, in your industries, you would think if somebody did that, they would be booted out, or at least fined, reprimanded, in some way tarnished, disciplined. It never happened. The Daily Express paid up to the McCanns. They did not pay their dues to the rest of journalism. We carried on our own sweet way, and you can go right back through every scandal that's befallen the British press since the war, and there have been lots of scandals. At no point has the PCC tightened itself. At no point have they said, this is terrible. We need to sort this out. We need, as a self-regulatory body, not just to be a complaints bureau, which is what it was. We actually need a power of investigation. We need to get all the papers in the room, all the proprietors, all the editors, and we're going to say, from now on, if we get a whiff of anything, we are going to come into your newsroom. We are going to seize notebooks. We're going to seize computers. It happens in every other industry. Every other industry in Britain has some form of regulation. Nightclub bouncers are regulated. They misbehave, they cease to be nightclub bouncers. Jockeys, we all think the Jockey Club is about the most anachronistic organisation in Britain, full of old duffers who own racehorses. And, you know, they actually sort out jockeys. They stop them whipping horses. The British press, we don't do anything. Now, the great principle, which has been mentioned, is we have a free press. None of that should stop us behaving freely. I mean, it's very interesting to hear this comparison with the BBC. The BBC, which does great journalism, fantastic journalism, day after day after day, hours and hours and hours on channels that most of us never even see. Amazing journalism. Of course they have the odd scandal. They had Jimmy Savile, they had McAlpine. But actually put it in context. The output of the BBC and its journalism is incredible. It is regulated by Ofcom. You don't hear BBC journalists saying at Panorama, I can't do my job, I can't expose this. They do undercover inquiries. They do exposés. They get on with it and they do it. And I don't understand why the printed press, well, I do understand what's going on and the hysteria and why that's being whipped up, but why the British press should be treated any different. And I'd say to those people in Rwanda, we have got self-regulation, but self-regulation hasn't worked. And what we're proposing is not law, it's merely a tightening of that self-regulation.